Welcome to AfterSight's High Country News Program. I'm KG Greenspun reading from the April edition. Starting today with the reportage section, the complex case of growing native plants. As the use of native plants becomes more widespread, indigenous communities could lose out, by Megan Ululani Boyantin. Households across the West are increasingly ditching the smooth green lawns of the stereotypical American dream and attempting to grow native plants instead, a practice indigenous communities mastered centuries ago to sustain themselves. The new approach to landscaping is championed by activists, government agencies, and universities as a simple solution to water and climate woes. But the indigenous farmers who originally cultivated and cared for some of these plants are often left out of the narrative sold to consumers. And the native plant movement could impact indigenous communities unexpectedly by taking away resources like crops, seeds, and income. What's growing out there is not considered a commodity for us, said Michael Katatwa Johnson, a member of the Hopi tribe and assistant specialist at the University of Arizona's School of Natural Resources and the Environment. It's considered a way of life and our key to survival. Take the Chiltepin chili pepper, for example, which grows wild throughout much of the Sonoran Desert. It's considered a traditional food of indigenous peoples in the region, including the Tohono O'odham Nation, but can be sold for hundreds of dollars per pound. Unregulated harvesting of wild chilies can be very destructive to the environment, said Ian McFaul, co-chair of the Phoenix chapter of the international movement Slow Food USA, and can certainly take food away from folks like the Tohono O'odham people. Crops endemic to different parts of North America fall under the wide umbrella of native or indigenous plants, which Native American tribes have cultivated for millennia. The current push to make indigenous plants trendy bothers Johnson because it fails to respect their inherent sacredness to indigenous people. Talking about it as being vogue, it's missing the whole point here, and that's part of the problem, he said. Meanwhile, the commercial industry reaps the financial benefits of selling native crops and other plants, with Johnson pointing to big ag corporations as violators that have taken advantage of indigenous cultivation to develop their new crop varieties. For example, Monsanto, which was acquired by Bayer in 2018, has patented seeds derived from native varieties and sued farmers who cultivate them over claims of patent infringement. We have a history here of exploitation, Johnson said. He argued that Native American people should be among the first to get proper credit for their contributions. Johnson suggested developing partnerships with them and supporting indigenous-led food organizations. For instance, the Plant Conservation Alliance, a non-native public-private partnership backed by the U.S. government, launched the National Seed Strategy in 2015 to tackle native seeds shortages by ensuring seed availability, enhancing seed production technology, and engaging tribal communities. Johnson depicted it as a start toward recognizing the contributions of indigenous people, although he's pushing to expand its access to more Native Americans. Native seeds, search, In Tucson, Arizona, conservatives and distribute seeds, primarily food crops like corn and beans, to tribal members in the southwest and northwest Mexico, as well as non-tribal retailers, community gardens, food access initiatives, and the general public. For Andrea Carter, Powhatan, Renape, the nonprofit's director of agriculture and education, giving proper credit to Native American seeds means specificity. Labeling a variety as Hopi blue corn instead of just blue corn, for example, and at times including its cultural use. Native seeds search goes beyond the standard practice of donating a portion of its proceeds to indigenous communities. It also offers knowledge and technical assistance to Native American agricultural producers to help them successfully grow from seed to plant. These are someone's seeds. These are a people's seeds. These are a culture's seeds. And to ignore that is a great disservice, Carter said. The Dene Native Plants Program, grant-funded program established in 2018 in Fort Defiance, Arizona, under the Navajo Nation's tribal government, uses outreach and education to reconnect people with native plants. Jesse Mike, Dene, program coordinator and forester, said the team teaches them the plants' names and brings in traditional practitioners to explain the memories interwoven with the plants and teach related uses and traditions like basket weaving. We're losing a lot of the traditional knowledge, he said. It's not being passed down to our younger generations. The program also restores ecologically degraded areas across the Navajo Nation and collects seeds from native plants, including grasses, wildflowers, shrubs, and trees, for a seed bank. Although Mike's team follows strict rules that limit the number of plants and seeds that can be collected, he worries that others in the commercial industry won't take the same precautions as the native plant movement grows. You definitely want to make sure that you're buying and sourcing your plant material from people who know what they're doing and people who respect all the nuances of native plant production, Dene Natives Plants Program horticulturist Dondi Begay Jr., Dene, added. And while books like Native Harvest, Authentic Southwestern Gardening by Kevin Dahl encourage everyday gardeners to plant corn, squash, beans, and more as an opportunity to benefit from the centuries-old agricultural legacy of this region, they skate over the historic injustices that prevented Native Americans from doing the same for hundreds of years. Indigenous people were forced onto newly created reservations in the 19th century by the U.S. government and compelled to abandon their traditional farming practices. The federal rations they received often included unhealthy foods such as lard, wheat, flour, and canned meats, which led to health disparities and high mortality rates from heart disease and diabetes. According to the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, the problem remains, with 1 in 4 Native people experiencing food insecurity. Now, government institutions, from the U.S. Forest Service to the Salt Lake City government, are encouraging the public to make use of native plants. Native plants differ from other flora because they've adapted to specific habitats and regions after thousands of years. Their deep root systems help the soil absorb heavy rains, reducing runoff that sweeps surface pollutants into local watersheds, meaning they can serve as a cost-effective, easily maintained means of cutting water pollution while also reducing erosion. One in four American adults intentionally bought native plants in 2021, jumping to 25% from 17% in 2020, according to the National Gardening Survey. Close to 20% of survey respondents plan to turn part of their lawns into native wildflower landscapes, which more than doubles the results from 2019 at 9%. The Southwest in particular faces serious issues like drought and overgrazing, so native plants are absolutely key in xeriscaping or landscaping based on the natural water needs of an area, said Mary Phillips of the National Wildlife Federation. Xeriscaping utilizes plants that aren't extremely thirsty. Ian McFall, who has worked with various indigenous communities as a Slow Food Board member in Arizona and California, spent the past few years re-indigenizing his yard with plants native to Arizona and other North American deserts. Now, hundreds of plant species, including wolfberries and saguaro cacti, are thriving feet from his house. However, McFall considers growing native plants to be a complex issue, particularly when it involves crops stewarded by indigenous communities. For example, Ramona Farms, an indigenous-run farm on the Gila River Indian Reservation, serves as the biggest supply of tepary beans for food. Farmer and co-owner Ramona Button and her family help save the beans, traditionally known as bav, from extinction for their community. If this is an indigenous food and non-native folks are planting it to sell in commerce, does that take away from what the Buttons and other native businesses and communities are doing with their crops? McFall asked, referring to the potential impact on the market demand for their beans. Ultimately, gardeners who seek to grow native plants ethically are encouraged to start by acknowledging where their plants come from, but that alone is far from enough. They need to be mindful of the fact that they'll never understand them completely, Johnson, the specialist at the University of Arizona, said. They don't have that intimate relationship. As Carter at Native Seeds /search put it, there'd be nothing to preserve had communities not saved seeds for generations, and that's a really remarkable thing. In a sidebar, gardening with agency. Over the coming months, High Country News will examine the many roles that gardening plays in the lives of Westerners and their communities. Through a limited series online and in print, we'll explore what gardening means in this moment. This series will include stories that are hyper-local or focused on the personal. We choose to launch with this piece on native plant gardening because it shows the broader ramifications of the decisions we make in our own gardens. Gardening is not done in isolation. The seeds we choose to plant and the ecosystems we foster have social and environmental impacts. Examining each decision is like looking at a spider's web dotted with dew. The droplets illuminate the intricacies of an interconnected and delicate system that is nearly invisible without attention. And now the co-opting of cowboy poetry and the story of one man who tried to reverse it by Meg Bernhard. When Justin Reichert was 18, he caught a ride with a friend from his family's farm in McPherson, Kansas, to Elko, Nevada, 1,200 miles away. It was 1992, the seventh year of Elko's National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, a series of readings and musical performances created to celebrate all the Westerners whose lives revolve around raising cattle. Reichert had never been to the event, which its fans call simply The Gathering, but he'd heard a lot about it. The son of a horse trader, Reichert competed in rodeos. He could, he said, ride anything with hair. But he wanted out of Kansas. He wanted to live and work as a cowboy out west. Reichert arrived in Elko, a cow town in the Sagebrush Flats at the foot of the snow-capped Ruby Mountains, with $10 and a book of his own shitty poetry to read at the gathering's open mic events. It was electric, he said. He went to the commercial casino, where bartenders slipped him alcohol despite his age, and he sneaked into the Stockman's casino, where 100 people at any given time would splinter into small groups to jam and sing and dance. The gathering made such an impression on him that he returned to Kansas and packed his bags. He moved to Idaho, where he apprenticed with a guy who made leather shaps and drifted between ranch jobs in the Great Basin, the start of a decades-long career as a cowboy. 20 years after that first event, Reichert finally returned. What he saw this time, though, left him cold. Elko was different now, a gold mining boomtown. The gathering had changed, too. Gone were the spontaneous jam sessions. Events were now meticulously organized, managed by people who, for the most part, didn't actively work on ranches. He felt that the gathering's target audience had shifted from ranch workers to folklorists and well-to-do cowboy cosplayers in buckskin jackets, who didn't know which end of the cow gets up first. Reichert spent the 5 days of the gathering getting drunk and lamenting the old days. The soul had been sucked out of it, he said. In 2014, Reichert decided to do something about it. He started the Outside Circle, now a two-night show held at the Star Hotel and Bar, a Basque restaurant in downtown Elko, during the same weekend as the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering. Outside Circle is a cowboy term. If you're assigned the Outside Circle, it means you're in charge of the biggest piece of land on a given day. The show aimed to recapture what Reichert sees as the gathering's original spirit. Raucous, organic, and all-around good time. Each year, the set list includes talented musicians and poets, with one catch. They have to have grown up on a ranch or be actively working as a cowboy. Reichert created the event with the help of his partner, Nicole Grady. Grady wasn't born on a ranch, but after packing mules in the eastern Sierra and breaking horses across the west, she'd come to revere the lifestyle. She and Reichert saw their project as a response to the National Cowboy Poetry Gathering's perception problem, that it's an event aimed at people who appreciate the cowboy culture but don't actually work in it. On the first Friday in February, three musicians who also worked on ranches in Texas arrived at the Star shortly before their sets began, guitars in tow. They headed to a back room near the kitchen, where performers congregated around a cooler of beers, strumming guitars, and talking about their homes, where they learned to ride, their travel plans once the weekend was over. "We're grateful to be here," said Hayden Redwine, the evening's first performer. "There's a lot of history in this town." The Outside Circle involves more than music and dancing. On February 3rd, in the atrium of the Stockman's Casino, Reichert and Grady held a panel dedicated to mental health. Five panelists spoke to a room of more than 50 people about the depression that accompanies work-related injuries, the loneliness of cowboying, and the temptation to use alcohol as a fix for pain and isolation. Jeremy Morris, a cowboy in Idaho and host of the Wild Courage podcast, said he'd had five DUIs, I'm so grateful I didn't kill anybody, he said. I'd drink so much I'd wake up in another state. For years, he hid behind his occupation, moving twice a year to new ranches as an excuse to live life on the run, trying to outrun the messes I was making. The panel was the outside circle's second ever discussion of mental health and addiction. These are difficult topics to broach in a culture that values toughness and self-reliance, but conversations of this kind are desperately needed in the West. Between 2000 and 2020, suicide rates in rural areas increased by 46%, outstripping the growth rate in cities, according to the Centers for Disease Control. And for cowboys, larger economic forces like low wages and agricultural consolidation aggravate the stress of an already lonely and unstable occupation. Today, ranchers earn 39 cents for every dollar consumers spend on beef, compared to 60 cents 50 years ago. And the financial disparity trickles down to the ranch hands. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, agricultural workers, a category that includes a range of jobs involving work with crops and livestock, earned $33,290 a year on average in 2022, significantly less than the average income for single earners in all states that year. Today, $3,000 a month is considered good pay. Reichert and Grady have held auctions to help struggling cowboys and their families, raising somewhere between $200,000 and $250,000, including for the daughter of a leather worker who suffered a debilitating stroke in 2022. Ranch work has always been dangerous. Panelists had been kicked by steers and bucked off horses. They spoke of the pressure to drink, often to excess, with other ranch hands when they were off work, and described how the stereotypes of ranch life in the rural West overlook its harsher realities. Scott Van Leeuwen, who oversees a ranch in Lovelock, Nevada, said it was hard for an alcoholic like him to be in the Stockman's Casino. He joked he'd been to every jail cell in Elko County. Getting sober was a lonely experience, he said. Our culture is so based on having a drink and having a good time, and then you go back to the ranch and go to work. The outside circle's mood shifted at night when the music began around 10 p.m. at the Star. On the first Friday in February, the restaurant was hot and airless, so crowded that people had to push through the sea of bodies at the bar just to reach the dining room where the musicians were. Inside, the crowd was loud, drowning out the musicians. Around 3 a.m., as Canadian country star Colter Wall was getting ready to perform, Reichert grabbed the mic and looked out into the crowd, noticing that his cowboy friends, who'd come there from ranches in Wyoming, Arizona, and Canada, had been pushed to the sides of the room, up against the walls. If you want to talk about trucks and dicks, there's another room, he said, borrowing a line from the musician, Mike Beck, who would play the following night. He sounded frustrated. The outside circle has a chip on its shoulder, said Randy Johnson, a poet and teacher from Eastern Oregon. She characterized it as a party for folks like her who grew up on ranches, while the cowboy poetry gathering catered more to people who appreciated that lifestyle but didn't necessarily live it. But she also saw a symbiosis between the two events. Performers like her and attendees often cycled from one to the other. Kristen Wynn Bigler, the chief executive officer of the Western Folklife Center, which runs Elko's National Cowboy Poetry Gathering, said that everyone who performed at the larger events, many shows, had some tie to ranch work. Her organization, she said, gave out 246 free day passes to cowboys and ranchers this year. Today, the outside circle faces the same concerns about scale and accessibility that inspired its creation in the first place. What started as a small budget show with low quality audio has morphed into something much bigger. So big, in fact, that this year, Colter Wall's fans drove 15 hours to listen to his gravelly baritone. Whether the outside circle can preserve its original flavor remains to be seen. That's the dangerous part about where we're at, Reichert said. This is about cowboys, but now our cowboy friends are tucked in the hallway behind the bar, and there are all these people who aren't making space for them. There was a fine line, he said, between protecting the outside circle and becoming its gatekeepers. Near the end of the Friday show, Reichert swooped up Grady and the couple began to swing dance. Other couples followed suit, stomping and spinning, and the room felt like something between a barn dance and a revival, joyous despite the weekend's occasional frustrations and heavier topics. Never stop, someone shouted as a performer from North Texas crooned. The singer kept playing. And that's the time we have for today. Thank you so much for joining me. You're listening to Aftersight.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.